Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey everyone, this is Angela Orkin. Welcome back to the podcast. Today I have a special guest. With me is Melissa Carter, who's the Executive Director of the Barton Child Law and Policy Center at Emory University School of Law, and she is also a clinical professor. But what's most important to you is she's here today to talk about an important federal policy change that, while it may not sound that exciting, can have a really big impact on representation throughout the country and in your state. So welcome, Melissa. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
So let's cut right to it. We want to talk about the 4E change, and if we can just start by telling us in simplest terms what it is and why it matters.
Yeah, so it's hard to make something this hyper-technical simple. But everyone in this area may generally have heard reference to Title 4E. Title 4E is this kind of robust backbone of financing for the child welfare system. It's the entitlement funding stream against which states can make claims for reimbursement for the eligible costs of care and placement and services for kids in foster care. And so that's the big financing moment of education. But then what's really happened is in early January, the Children's Bureau under the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees all the state child welfare programs, amended its guidance, this manual, Child Welfare Program Policy Manual online, to make clear that that 4E entitlement funding stream could be accessed for purposes of providing legal representation for children and parents at all stages of dependency or child welfare proceedings. So it's always been available to support agency representation, and so now it's been expanded to allow for legal representation for all parties.
Okay, and so what this means in simple terms, and correct me if I'm oversimplifying, is that there has not been before, but there is now a potential federal funding source for child and parent representation.
Yep, you simplified it better than I did. That's exactly what's happening.
So then the big questions would be, if 4E is typically limited to foster care, does that mean that you could only get money for representation when the child is in foster care?
No, I mean, it does mean that. It means that you can get money for representation for children who have been removed into foster care. Certainly means that. I think, but the even more exciting thing about this really hyper-technical policy wonky thing is that this change was adopted in anticipation of states implementing the new Family First legislation. And so it says in the regulation, in the guidance, that this money is available to support candidates for foster care, which is the way we're now talking about children who are at risk of entering foster care if we don't give them the right services and intervention. And children who are in foster care, and the caregivers, parents and relative caregivers of both candidates and kids in foster care. So in sum, both kids who are at risk of entering foster care, kids who are in foster care, and their caregivers, parents and otherwise.
Okay, so that, again, simplifying for means that there is potential. It's definitely for kids in foster care, so we could definitely get some funding for representation when they're in foster care or if they meet this definition of candidate.
That's right.
Which is still TBD?
Yeah, a little bit. There's guidance, again, from the federal government that candidate means kids who are at imminent risk if you don't give them the services they need to prevent removal.
Okay.
But beyond that, states are going to have to define what candidate means at the state level of operationalizing that idea.
Okay. Well, so, you know, as we're talking about this, what comes to mind for me is I have been in three different states, really. And I should have mentioned we're here in Georgia. So we're going to hear a few reflections on how things might happen here, and hopefully that'll be of interest. In Florida, there's a large system of representation that is state-funded. I was in Pittsburgh, and that was county-based. And then in Georgia, we have a mix of all of those things. So I guess the relevance of this funding stream will depend a lot on state, how it's set up, and whether who the decision makers are. And I guess that's the next question. So who gets to decide whether a state would take advantage of this?
I mean, in a really maybe oversimplified way, the answer is whoever your state child welfare director is. Because the 4E agency, which in most all states is the public child welfare agency, is who is going to have to be responsible for administering these funds. But certainly I think there, and for the reason that we are talking about this today, there is every reason and need for all of the judicial and legal community to know about this new opportunity, to think about it for its transformative potential, as well as its ability to sustain what's already happening, and to engage with the child welfare leadership to make sure the state moves in that direction.
So, yeah, that I was thinking in terms of, you know, who gets together now that this is out there, you know, who are the players? So if a lawyer out there listening is sitting in a small county in South Georgia and they want to find out if anything's happening, you know, who do you reach out to? Court improvement offices, child welfare agency leadership, you know, probably any of the real involved policy advocates in the area.
Right.
Why might a state choose not to do it? Why wouldn't they?
Well, I would go back and really quick pick up judicial leadership too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking of court improvement. I kind of moved it in, but you're right. It's, yeah, judicial leadership for sure.
I think that's right. So why might a state not want to do this? So
why wouldn't they bother?
I think, you know, though the policy is now more flexible, and that's very exciting, and in that way it creates a new opportunity. There are lots of complexities and unevenness in terms of a state's ability to access this promise of 4E entitlement funding. So what the policy says and the new regulation and guidance, really, not to use the wrong official term, is that states can claim up to 50% of administrative costs. There are a whole lot of other factors that go into a state's ability to penetrate, what they call penetrate Title 4E, which may mean that the state, this is not a windfall. This is not just a big check to pay for all of representation. It's certainly never that easy. And then I think, too, there are lots of issues about implementing this policy. So, for example, for those who were kind of tuned into the possibility of this, once it was released, was a moment of celebration and excitement. And then the advocacy community, the judicial and legal community, has really immediately started to talk about whether this creates an insurmountable conflict of interest for the state child welfare agency, who is the one seeking and, you know, using the power of the state to seek removal or in other interventions in families, should be writing the checks, so to speak, for representation of other parties. For lawyers, and we immediately think about our ethics and the kind of parameters around that. So that's one aspect, in addition to it just not being that easy to access as a sort of direct cash payment.
I'm trying to imagine. I mean, I of course we look at those things. I'm trying to imagine who would make that argument. Like, practically speaking, why would we, I guess, talk ourselves out of it? I guess the question would be, is there some control? Where is the control over the representation? Could there just be a funding? Could the money come straight through and into, and this goes to kind of what interests me, which is having some sort of state infrastructure to support lawyers in the field. I've seen that done. I mean, again, Georgia's a good example because there are some offices of children's attorneys, but then there are also a lot of counties that are contracting with individuals who do it on a part-time basis or a full-time basis. They, you know, if there was an opportunity to create a central place where attorneys could share best practices and do some more of that type of work, I could see it as a real advantage. And I guess the question is how you set up the money and control. In terms of whether is there any control over the representation.
I would expect there'll be a lot of good, there's going to be a lot of good thinking about this. I think at the end of the day, though, right, this is an opportunity we haven't had before. It's not something that creates an inherent conflict on its face. I think it is about how you set up the apparatus to administer all of this. So it wouldn't be something where the agency is directing the course of representation of a parent attorney, for example, which is where that conflict starts to feel, where you start to feel the conflict.
Right.
And I do think, to your point, that in setting up that infrastructure, it really invites a lot of good thinking and maybe change that would allow for some greater cohesion, some greater communities of practice to be built. One experience we had here in Georgia, as you mentioned, we've got lots of different models. So in the urban courts, we have county-based offices of child attorneys, for example. We have mostly throughout the state the model that you find mostly throughout the country, which are individual practitioners on contract locally to provide these this kind of representation. And they usually do that in combination with other kinds of legal practice, right, which may be completely unrelated to families and children.
Right.
And what we all know that we need as people who do specialize this is greater specialization. And what those attorneys need is more training and more access to resources, more access to each other even as a resource. Georgia was one of the two demonstration sites for the Child Rep QIC that the Children's Bureau supported, the other being Washington State, and I had a privilege of playing a role in all of that. And I think there are lots of big takeaways about, and there's lots of good conversation about how that informs what we're here to talk about today. But being on the ground here, what was really clear was how we have really good lawyers, really good legally trained people who are very well intended about providing that really good legal work for children and families who are just, they don't know what they don't know. They're just out there on their own. And that really the big value was in creating some connection among practitioners so that they can use each other as resources and sounding boards and thought partners and all of that. So I think I think the apparatus for administering this dollars can insulate, I believe, everyone from those conflict concerns and also move us in a direction of real benefit for building greater quality and definition around our practice areas.
Well, one of the reasons to your point is I was so excited about it is that when I was hired to essentially set up a state office in Florida for the program there, we had something, similar to Georgia in that it was, different throughout the state, but they were all county-based or circuit-based programs. And they're same thing. You had mostly full-time lawyers, but even so, they weren't really connected to one another. And when we first set it up and we sat down with everybody, we came up with this huge list of things that they wanted. And they were very simple things. I mean, it was, they wanted to be able to communicate with each other, which, most states don't have. Right. They wanted access, they wanted case law updates. I did that in month one, and they still do it there today. And it seems like such a minor thing. But when you're killing yourself with these caseloads and everything, just having just some simple support, some networking, some opportunities to get together and problem solve and share best practices, we all talk about it, but having experienced it and seen what it meant to the lawyers just to have some of these really basic things, I get excited, about the possibility for funding, but I guess all things to be determined would be, you're getting reimbursed for representation. Right. That means you have to be able to hang on to what your state's already putting in. And if it's at the county level, those things would have to be worked out. But I think if lawyers out there would like to see some of these things and want to have more resources and connectedness and a network and organized trainings and opportunities to get together, then you need to engage in this process and help push it to make it happen, because it's certainly not easy from, just the little bit we've talked about, but it may need, in some states, it may really need to come from the lawyers, because not every agency is out there looking for more better prepared lawyers.
Well, right. And that's why we find ourselves where we are, which is it's really hard to get, for example, state or local funding to support lawyers. The idea of more lawyers and lawyers for kids, and we know how controversial that's all been, and lawyers for indigent clients is always a challenge. There are endless examples of that readily available to us. And so again, that's why this feels like such an exciting opportunity. And yet, certainly, there are still all of the same presenting challenges for how you would implement this, all of which really good, hardworking, good thinking people can overcome. There's no question about that. So I would agree. This is the opportunity to reach for. This is the ring to grab for if you're interested in that, in some greater cohesion, sort of collectiveness to the practice, quality, resources, all of that.
Well, and I think too that whenever, I know that this was my experience with state funding for sure, the use it or lose it mentality. But if there is some sign that the feds are valuing this and that they see the potential to impact the outcomes for kids through funding good representation, if we don't take advantage of it, what message does that send?
I agree.
And, even if we try to take advantage of it and it's ugly and, it's hard, and at least we can come back and say we've been trying under this model, maybe there's a simpler way to get at this. Right. But if states just kind of let it sit out there, then I think we lose the opportunity to continue to make the case and potentially maybe have an easier system.
I think this is that tough invitation to accept, which is like be a part of the solution, right? In a system that is always operating on an indigent basis and has the kinds of challenges that we have, both in terms of the nature of what we're doing, right? Urgent, high stakes, thankless in many ways, and all the other related challenges systemically, it's easy to find all the reasons to complain and all of that. This is a chance to figure out how to solve for it. And I think even beyond figuring out how to sustain or reinforce what we already have by way of representation, the other, I think, implied offer here is to figure out how to innovate, to do things better. The whole point of this, and where it's clear that there is full-throated support, endorsement from the feds, is around this idea of lawyers matter. Legal representation, quality, competent legal representation matters for the outcomes this system is required to seek. And the outcomes we all embrace as you know, when we go to work every day. So there's a really good read. So the policy manual change happened in early January, and then shortly thereafter, the Children's Bureau issued one of their information memorandum, right, to elaborate on all of this. And if anyone hasn't seen it, it's available online at the Children's Bureau website. It's IM1702. What's really nice is you get that sense of support, because what this is a very comprehensive and yet succinct recitation, explanation for why lawyers matter, what the evidence has been so far, how that evidence adds up to support this direction. And then I think we all need to figure out now what to do with it.
Well, and I would be remiss if I did not kind of make the point here on behalf of True North Child Advocates. One of our main points is that children's lawyers have the power to really push the system and to get kids out of care faster, and to, you know, in the case of Palm Beach County, where the Foster Children's Project has operated, one of the fascinating things is that the county, it's a community-based care agency, supports the lawyers so much that they asked for another lawyer for them. So even though kind of in theory you think, well, you know, why would the agency want more lawyers pushing on their staff and creating all of this tension? And there certainly has been tension when big changes have come through. At the end of the day, we really all are trying to get kids home, whatever that is, as soon as possible. And I think if the lawyers are doing that and showing that, then we really are in sync, even if it's maybe uncomfortable at times, or if there's more zealous advocacy, you know, all of those things. And so I think that's one of the reasons that it's just so important that lawyers engage now with this opportunity and let it be known that we believe that we can absolutely impact outcomes. Maybe we have too many cases to do that now. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe this is where you make the case for, we can do this, but we need less cases, or we can do this, but we feel like, you know, we'd rather have one full-time lawyer instead of a bunch of people doing a handful of cases. I mean, there's lots of ways to look at it, but ultimately it's kind of goes to our ongoing message of lawyers being willing to step into the driver's seat and say, okay, we take you up on this, and we'll tell you how we can help support your outcomes.
Yeah, I think that, right, so there has been evaluative work, and there are publications of you know, different magnitudes and rigor, but the conclusions here are that lawyers are really important for maybe the thing that's most obvious for all lawyers, like this idea of procedural justice, right? That you give a voice to someone, and by giving them that voice and telling their story in a way that feels authentic to them, they trust the process, they'll accept the outcome better as a more fair and just outcome, even if they don't agree with it. Well, that seems like that gets us somewhere, right? When we think about case plan compliance and this path, this journey that we're on with families.
Well, and even children. Absolutely. Even children accepting the decisions and staying in the place that they're supposed to be so that they can get to the next place. I mean, I think I always think about those in terms of parents' compliance. But really, when I was representing kids, it was the teens who really needed to feel
heard.
And they could, and they could understand why they couldn't go X place now, but they needed to be a part of that rather than just being told no.
Yeah, they totally know the judge makes the decisions, as we all know, don't we, as lawyers? But I think that's important. But to help them have an instrumental, equal role in the information that's presented to the judge, for the integrity of that decision, in the process itself, no one likes to, especially teenagers, right, like to feel like they're not understood. This is the chance for engagement. So engagement, procedural justice, acceptance of outcomes. We see, right, all this good work around expedited permanency, around more individualized case plans. All of that is the stuff we're starting, I guess we feel like we've already always known, maybe, if you do this work, right, you're really committed to that. But now there is, if you will, evidence of that. And I do think, you know, this is the chance now we have a firm footing to move forward and embrace that more fully and use that as the momentum and energizing place for the next wave of stuff. And still, you know, as I was saying, because despite all of that, we know we don't get good outcomes all the time for every child consistently. And so there's work to be done in ensuring safety and permanency and well-being and everything that those big buckets mean for every individual child and mm-hmm. family.
Well, I think, was there anything else that you wanted to add in particular about the 4E piece? I want to just kind of take a minute and give folks some places to look if they want to stay engaged. But is there anything, do you think, any big pieces we missed?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the takeaway here, right, is our child welfare system is largely a financing mechanism. There's been an alteration here that speaks directly to the value of lawyers representing all parties, and that means through the access to funds for that, and that we have some thinking to do and some designing to do in order to take full advantage, but that I certainly am of the belief that it's worth it, and that we should definitely move in that direction.
And for lawyers out there that are hearing this for the first time and are interested, a couple of the places that you can look to stay informed, obviously the National Association of Counsel for Children. You could look to the ABA Center on Children and the Law. They tend to, you know, be up on these topics. And if you had a specific question and you wanted to reach out to us, our email is just info@childrenslaw.org. We'd try to be happy to try and help. But the main thing we just want to say, and in addition to thank you for listening, is let's take this opportunity, all of you out there, to really step up and try to make this happen. And I'd like to say thank you to Melissa for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.